Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. For the remainder of the program, we're going to listen to witnesses who survived the Holocaust. The stories are very powerful, and a warning, they can also be very painful to hear. In the 1990s, the town of Brookline recorded the stories of dozens of Holocaust survivors. For decades, the tapes of those interviews were locked up and forgotten in a storage closet. Now we can hear them.
I did everything possible to survive. And I walked with my head up, and I thought, now I'm going to kill these Nazi murderers. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't kill anybody. I couldn't do anything.
Filmmaker Harvey Brovman rescued more than 80 hours of those stories and made them into a documentary called Soul Witness, the Brookline Holocaust Witness Project. We spoke with Harvey about the film, and he told us about what it was like when he came across those tapes.
The first time I held the tape, it was like waves coming over me. It's almost like I knew my life was about to change. I felt like I was their last chance.
As I understand it, Harvey, there was more than 80 hours of tape. How did you know to turn it into this project?
These survivors were aching to be heard. And it took three really incredible people just to record these stories. The original Brookline Holocaust Witness Project was started by a survivor, Leon Satinstein, who at the age of 19 witnessed the liberation of Dachau. Leon met Regina Barshak, who was a survivor from France, and the two of them came up with this idea of a living memorial, that instead of erecting a physical structure, it was a great listening project.
The final product, the documentary, is simple, but if you don't mind me saying, it is utterly devastating to watch. You kept it simple, I think, to keep those stories clear. Why is it so powerful to tell about the Holocaust that way?
When we first think of the Holocaust, we think of the atrocities that happened to people. But we don't think about what happens inside of a person. And I think the film tells the hidden story of what happens to the human psyche. It was very important to me that we didn't see these people as heroes, that we could see their beauty. But I think the moral of the story isn't that people survived the Holocaust. I think the moral is that beautiful people, just like those in this film, didn't survive.
The people featured in the film share really harrowing stories of tragedy, survival. One of them is Rena Chernoff, who talks about when her family spent Rosh Hashanah at Auschwitz. She says the Germans were always looking for ways to ruin Jewish holidays, and that this time they claimed there was a measles outbreak and were writing down the numbers of young boys who they would kill.
My mother came that evening to the wire fence to see my father and my brother. And my mother asked my brother, did they take down your number? And my brother didn't answer at all. He just threw his piece of bread that he got to my mother over the fence, and he said, you take it. I won't need it anymore. And he ran away.
What struck you about Rena's story?
I think what struck me about Rena's story was Rena herself, the way she could clearly articulate what happened. It was like she was watching a film from the past. And so she was sort of the journalist of the survivors.
Harvey, later in the film, one of the subjects, Rose Murrah, talks about the pain of parents who had to watch and listen to their children's screams as they were being beaten or killed. Also vice versa, children having to witness what was happening to their parents, both being able to do nothing about it. In another subject, Judith Katz talks about how she was actually robbed of her childhood and of that innocence that should come with childhood. The subjects here were all adults when the tapes were made. They dealt, though, with trauma of a lifetime. They discussed the lasting effects physically, emotionally, mentally. How did that reality resonate with you, and how do you want it to resonate with people who see the documentary?
My goal in the film was to put the audience in the shoes of the survivor. They wanted you to know who they loved and who mattered to them, and that they're just like you and I, and so that we could try to imagine what it would be like if that had happened to us, and to learn some of the damage that happens to people that we don't think about. To me, one of the hidden crimes is what survivors did to themselves in their own mind. Survivors felt guilt for surviving.
There's a really striking moment in one of the stories. It's George Foldy, and it really struck me because it's both a moment of resilience, but also a moment of him choosing to survive when someone else didn't. He's on a death march. They're marching day and night. He talks about being so hungry that he ate his own belt, just trying to give himself something to fuel his body to keep going. And during the death march, two twin boys that he knew from high school stopped, and he talks about what happened next.
One of them couldn't walk anymore, just collapsed, and the brother went to help him up. One of the guards get over there and shoot both of them. Then 15 minutes after that, I fell on my knees. And I got real mad. I'm not 20 years old yet. I didn't hurt anybody. I didn't do anything. I'm just too young to die. And I got up and I kept going.
Just before that, he talks about the fact that he knew that the guards had been told to shoot and kill anyone who couldn't keep walking. The determination of that, coupled with the haunting that you can see from him because he did get to keep walking and these boys he knew from high school didn't, tell so much more than just hearing the words. How do you think someone like George keeps going when so many other people didn't get to or couldn't or never had the chance?
George was military trained. His story is like Mission Impossible on steroids. Before this scene, before he was taken and put in this war camp, he was sabotaging airfields in Hungary. And he was actually later part of the Hungarian resistance against the Soviet Union. He had learned to survive, and so I think he was going by his instincts, but he also had this other kind of will that was unshakable. I've gotten to know a lot of the family members of these people, and it's really incredible to see the character, the kind of people that they raised after going through this trauma.
What do you mean by that?
It's not in the film, but I heard a survivor say that they had a good life during the day, that they had a family and children and happiness, but every night they went to bed in Auschwitz. And talking to the family members, interviewing the family members, they talk about their parents' screams in the night, the tortures that they went through. And they also talk about how loving and beautiful they were as parents. And they try to protect their children from the realities of what they experienced in the Holocaust. They wanted their children to grow up feeling hope and living a good life.
I think of one of the survivors, Esther Gens, who talks about how we should think about the roles the Germans and others had in the Holocaust.
These people really were not monsters out of space. They're ordinary people. Ordinary people were the perpetrators, and ordinary people were the victims. And ordinary people were the bystanders. And everybody had choices except for the victims.
Part of what is striking about that is the fact that people who did survive then actually had the incredible demand of having to go live an ordinary life afterward. What do we take away from that understanding?
I think it's important to note that they had to go through that the rest of their life, most of them without help. A lot of us have therapists. I have a therapist that she helped me get through the film to make it. These people didn't have anyone to listen to them, to help them, to help them navigate the rest of their lives. When the war ended, they had no country. They had no family. They had no trust. Where do you go without those three things? After World War II, people weren't listening to Holocaust survivors. Even the Jewish community wasn't. So they waited 45 years to tell their story. And when they finally did, they were told that their testimonies would be part of a living memorial. And that living memorial never came to be. So after waiting 45 years to tell their story, they had to wait another almost 30 years before the public could hear those stories.
Let's stay on that for a minute, Harvey.
Sure.
Why did no one want to let the Holocaust survivors tell their stories when they got here? Why did it take 40, 45 years before people could sit and listen or even welcome someone to tell the story?
I think it comes down to people don't want to listen to what's difficult to hear. Their family members would tell them that they don't need to talk about it, that those types of things don't happen in the United States, that that's in the past, and they don't have to worry about it. The term PTSD didn't exist then, but we all have memories of things when we were young that cause us pain now.
That are traumatic.
Right.
From what you know, what did it mean to the survivors when the Brookline Project finally gave them an opportunity to tell their stories?
I really believe that the survivors told their stories for our benefit. They went through great pain to tell these stories. They went through pain when they agreed to do it. A lot of them had to be convinced to do it. And I've come to learn they went through pain after.
At the end of the film, Arthur Friedman, the nephew of one of the survivors, Leon Satinstein, talked about what it was like for Jews who had survived the Holocaust to reckon with what they'd been through.
They tried to talk to people that they met, to in the synagogue, to the rabbis, to others, to family members that they had. Nobody wanted to listen to them. They were trembling with the remembrances of their experiences.
The Holocaust is a specific and unique trauma for people. One of the lessons it seems like Arthur Friedman is talking about there, however, is that people have trauma in their lives and they try to ask for help from their communities. And communities have a choice to make about whether to listen and respond and support or not. You've said these survivors didn't have people providing that support. Synagogues are going to watch this documentary. people from religious parishes are going to watch this documentary. Community members are going to watch this documentary. What commitment do you want them to make when they come out afterward?
We all have images from after the war, the bombed out cities, the gruesome scenes from concentration camps. We can fix our cities. We can rebuild them. We can mourn our dead. But how do you help mend and heal the wreckage that goes inside of a human's mind and their heart if they've survived something like this? I hope from the film people have a higher level of vigilance about staying present in the face of all kinds of unjustifiable hate and intolerance.
You have said that these tapes changed your life. How?
I think the people in the tapes changed my life. They gave me strength to complete the film. I had never made a feature-length film. I knew a lot about the Holocaust, but I wasn't a scholar. And I had 9 months to produce the work-in-progress version that was first seen at the Coolidge. I spent 12 to 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, in the first stage of this project, just living inside of the testimonies. I only had a limited budget. I had put my business on hold so that I could make the film. And I doubted myself. I'm not Ken Burns. And the survivors got me through it. That was the hardest part, was living in the testimonies, because I had to go about doing the regular things too, right? I was walking around this earth with too much perspective.
Ordinary life.
At the time that I felt the most doubt about myself, I was watching the testimony of Alan Shaw. And the film ends with his words. And I was feeling sorry for myself. Imagine you're listening to Holocaust testimonies and you're feeling sorry about yourself. But we all get self-obsessed. And after listening to him, and I just realized I needed to grow up and make the film and just do it. This was my calling. This was what I was meant to be doing.
One of the single most intimate gifts someone can share with someone else is their story. There is an incredible amount of giving by sharing these stories that comes through in this documentary. What should the long-term legacy of that sharing be?
I hope it opens the doors for us to listen to other survivors from other atrocities, but maybe also our family members. I'm guessing that people who survive rape, that one of their biggest issues is no one will listen to them tell about that unspeakable experience they went through. And maybe it'll help us listen to each other. There's nothing we could do about the Holocaust. It's past. It ended before most of us were born. But we can do something about how we treat each other, I think.
That's Harvey Bravman talking about his film Soul Witness, the Brookline Holocaust Witness Project. Harvey, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
There will be a free screening of Soul Witness tonight at the Psy Performance Center at Boston University. You can find out more information on our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.